No way, Jose.
The following footage proves beyond any doubt that the tanks intentionally set the house on fire. It proves that the Branch Davidians were murdered. You can see that this tank has a gas jet on the front that shoots fire. You can also see the fire quite plainly. The tank goes into the house twice, and each time as it backs out, the fire at the gas jets is plainly visible.
We must all do more to recognize and look for the early warning signals that deeply troubled young people send.
Just realized I had it muted. My bad. Hey guys, this is Jose Galison. You're watching No Way Jose. Find us on the No Way Jose YouTube channel, all the major audio podcatchers, and Rumble as well. Today my guest is Jim Bovard. I do remind you guys how this works. At least I know I have my live stream show now that I'm doing weekly, but I also have my episodes like this, which I usually keep behind like a roughly a week or so paywall. And if you want to get that early stuff, be able to see, you know, check it out early. I do a live stream for you guys as well for the patrons. It gives you an access to ask questions and all sorts of other stuff. Differing levels. The lowest level just for the early stuff is $2. It's patreon.com/NoWayJose2020. The highest level, I read them off every episode. Those are my Patreon sponsors. Then I have Toad, who's my co-host on Tower Gang. You follow him at Tower Gang Toad. Then I have at Abrogate D's, then Kevin B. Clark, a full-time guitarist and private music teacher in the New York area. Then at @ZOVERACK, then @_InfiniteZeal, then Jacob Daniel of the Biblical Anarchy podcast, @BiblicalAnarchy, was on his show not too long ago. Then I have Tim Tuttle, @JollyOnKlebold, then @StinkySock420, he's a singer of a band, a metalcore band, it's called Bender. I checked out some of the music. I definitely dig it. If you like metalcore, that will be your thing. I do want to give a big shout out to those guys. I appreciate you guys for supporting me through these ventures. And I also want to give one final last shout out to my actual, I guess we call them our corporate sponsor. This is foxandsons.coffee. Use Jose at checkout to receive 15% off your orders of $30 or more. This is at www.foxandsons.com. Let them know I sent you. Use that Jose checkout code. And with that, let's get Jim Bovard in here because I am excited to talk to him. This has been a long time coming. With that, hey, how are you, Jim?
Good. I'm running late as usual. So there's a reason I've never been hired as an interior decorator.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it is kind of surreal having you on. It is funny. I don't know if it was Duncan, but there was this period from probably like 2016 to like 2020 range before I started a podcast. And I was just kind of lurking around on Facebook and getting like really interested in a lot of these type of stories, like Duncan Lemp and other similar things in this vein. A lot of the, gun rights types people, a lot of stuff was going on around that time. And I don't remember if I actually had a hand in helping you out, like, not necessarily helping you out, quote unquote, but just kind of putting you down certain paths and be like, oh, check this out during the Duncan Lemp. But there have been a few times that we were kind of Facebook pals.
Good. During well, that period thanks. Of times. Thanks. There were a number of folks, yep. When the Duncan Lemp shooting went down in March 2020. There's a lot of stuff I was trying to figure out real quick, and people like you helped me out, and I appreciate that.
Yeah, I don't remember what I said or if that might have even been a different scenario, but I know there were a couple times, and so it is just interesting to, you know, things have come full circle. Now I have you on my show to talk about this story that I really do think, I mean, you may not accept this, you seem like a humble guy. you in many ways are kind of a bit of a hero when it comes to this story of Duncan Lemp, because I don't know if you re-listened to, I interviewed Casey Robinson, the, you know, Duncan Lemp's girlfriend at the time.
Yeah.
And we even said in the episode, we credited you, because I really do feel like if it hadn't been your on the ground reporting, this really wouldn't have gotten the story it deserved, or at least and this may sound bad, but the spin it deserved, although not saying it's spin because it has like a negative thing to it, but it didn't get put the other spin on it, essentially. You were able to get there early, give us factual information, and kind of allow this not to get, I guess, astroturfed, essentially. So I do want to give a big thanks to you, and I really do think you were essential in, you know, getting this story to what it is, you know, and I guess what it almost should be as well.
Thanks very much. That's very kind. You know, it was the shooting happened, you know, just down the road from here, as they would say in the South, probably about 5-6 miles from where I live. And it's a much more affluent area than where I live. But still, I mean, it's the same county. And if something like this had happened in Baltimore City, people would say, yeah, well, it was Thursday. So, but in Montgomery County, it's kind of like, you know, where the hell is this going from? But it was, you know, I'm glad I had some good, really good editors early on to work with Kelly Vlahos, Jordan Bloom, people like that, American Conservative. Later on, Ryan McMakin at Mises. So, but there were a lot of editors who would not touch this story with a 10-foot pole. I mean, I was, you know, I sent out a lot of queries on this story, a lot of pitches, submissions, and let's just say that my hitting average on this story was a lot lower than it usually is. So
yeah, I got to give you credit for that. A lot of people, I don't think, realize the headaches that editors can be, especially when you're trying to get out, stories like this that are really important and really cutting edge. I mean, I'm not a journalist at all. I've dabbled a little bit with writing some stuff and I got published in one journal and, you know, just kind of like dabbling here and there. And it is like, just getting in there, it's almost discouraging for a fledgling writer when you do get into the editor's process and dealing with that type of stuff. This is why things like self-publishing, I think, have become so popular as of late. Because there really is, everyone has a different process. Everyone's a little bit more finicky or whatever. And there's no set process. Just some dude that's like, yep, you're good. You can push this on to the next level. And that's kind of really what it comes down to. I don't know if you have any thoughts on that. I just find that interesting for those who've never dabbled in there.
Well, so. Yeah. I mean, there's some editors I've worked with that were just really great and helped me understand how to improve my writing and helped me to recognize the weaknesses that I had and maybe still have to a degree in my writing. And then there are the FUBAR editors, mm-hmm. fucked up beyond all recognition.
Yep.
You send a story and they say, well, yeah, I just made a few little changes, and you get back the edited copy and you're thinking of like, ah, oh, I mean, there's I've had battles with editors at large papers, had to fight like hell to block them from putting false information in the first sentence of my story. It's like, you know, okay, can we at least not mislead readers in the first sentence? I mean, shit, I make errors, but to have an editor who's like, well, let's fuck the story in the first paragraph is like, you know, y'all don't pay me enough to do that. So anyhow, not that I'm bitter.
No, I get it. It is like, it's one of those things that even if it is, I think a lot of times coming from a place of trying to improve you, even if it is that, like, there are definitely, I would assume, like you just mentioned, situations for most writers where it is someone that is being difficult or trying to change your story. But sometimes, even in the case with someone trying to improve you, it is something about writing, you put a little bit more of yourself. It's kind of like art in a lot of ways, where it's like, it is a little bit of a poke in the heart almost when someone even, like, you know, wants you to change this or do that or points out your flaws. So even just that alone is just,
well, it's, yeah, it's kind of a double-edged sword. I mean, it's really helpful if there's good editors who have an appreciation of what you're trying to do and help you do it better than you could have done by yourself. I mean, that's a transcendent blessing. I mean, over the years, I've found some editors who appreciate my voice, my style, my humor. And then there's quite a few others who I dealt with once. And it's kind of like, well, you know, I, this is a pretty good article, but this is snarky, you know, and this newspaper doesn't do snark. And I say, well, that's why you're so god-awful boring, you know. Add some spice, add some humor. I mean, I've starting out as I did as a college dropout and just trying to, you know, bang on doors to get myself in, it was political satire that got me in the first couple times at New York Times. And that was out. And it was funny because so many other places would not even consider what I was sending. But then, you know, you shoot for a better market that appreciated the satire writing. And boom, you know, I found an open door.
Yeah, there definitely is a little bit. Every article of yours I read, there just is like a little bit of a taste of snark in there. You can't help it. I don't know if it's just the way you word certain things, but you definitely.
Well, I mean, this is who I am. and part of it, too, is that, you know, an awful lot of public policy writing is so god-awful boring. I mean, it's like they're on fucking Quaaludes before they even sit down at the keyboard. And they just stupefy readers in the first few paragraphs. And it's something like, like the hearing on Tuesday with Robert Herr. I was watching that, and I did a story for New York Post. And I was trying to make, well, how can I make this playful? And then it occurred to me, I don't know if you ever saw the movie The Manchurian Candidate. Does that ring a bell?
Rings a bell. Yeah, I think I watched the Denzel version. Yeah, forever
ago. Okay, yeah. It was Frank Sinatra, early 60s, just before Kennedy got assassinated, which was a great timing. But it was about how the North Koreans had captured American soldiers and brainwashed them. And they would all say that this officer, he's the most kind, gentle, courageous person I ever knew. And watching that hearing, it struck me that's what the Democrats were doing. Joe Biden is the most honest, courageous, intelligent politician I've ever known. It's just like, God, this is such a load of crap. I mean, do people actually believe this stuff? And so, and then you try to get the visual image. And I was watching the stuff, and you had one Democrat after another pressuring the special counsel to say, well, Biden was exonerated, right? And he's saying, no, he wasn't. And it was like watching a wrestling match where you have all these people come up and put the Robert Herr, the counsel, put them in a headlock and jam words in his mouth. Say exoneration. It's like, you know, I mean, there's comic elements there. I mean, a lot of people were so upset about all the bullshit, but shit, it's a congressional hearing. What did you expect?
Yeah, so. It is interesting you brought up how it is kind of fucking boring, this domestic policy stuff, but there are real consequences, and that's kind of why we're here today.
Oh, immensely. Yeah. I mean, deadly consequences. So,
yes, and I think that's part of the issue is they make it boring because it just sounds, I don't know, bureaucratic, administrative, you know, just kind of bleh when you read these things about whether how they're going to execute certain warrants or whatever. But this story that we're talking about today kind of reveals the real world consequences of it. And I re-listened to the Casey episode today just to kind of like give just to relive it. And that episode, I will say, I've done a whole playlist for those interested. I did a whole series where I did like a 3-part thing. We broke it down and did something like in the realm of 5 to 10 hours on the topic. Wow. But, you know, I also did that episode with Casey, and that was more of an emotional type thing to kind of get the real world consequence, which I think a lot of people don't think about this stuff, like how this affects someone. I tend not to be like the guy that goes the emotional route, but there are real world consequences for this thing. And there is a child out there who's growing up without his father that was probably would have, his mom and dad probably still would have been together. They had like their romance from having her on reminds me a lot of me and my wives, and we've been together over a decade and have 2 kids. So it's like, who knew what their future held? And that's been a future that's been destroyed.
Yeah. And it's sad that there's so little interest in holding the police accountable, so little interest in holding the politicians accountable, because it was the local politicians and Maryland politicians who basically have rubber stamped this type of police abuse, and no interest in holding the judge who signed off on a no-knock warrant. It's kind of like, well, did you ever ask if the police tried to talk to the guy before they killed him? No, well, no, it's just, this is how we normally do things. It's like,
yeah. Yeah, Casey.
Maryland is one of the worst states in the country for police power. So
yeah, Casey brought that up in the episode multiple times that she, knowing the weeks prior they had gone out for a little, like, I don't know, to go see the doctor for her checkups. You know, it wasn't like he was a, this wasn't, and the funny thing is I'd say, I'm about to like evoke Waco here, and be like, it wasn't a Waco compound situation, but even with Waco, Koresh was going on runs regularly. But
No. It's a hell of a lot worse than that, yeah. Because as the FOIA came out six years after the attack, Koresh had gone out target shooting with the undercover ATF yep. agents 8 or 9 days before the mass raid, the first assault by the feds. And it's like, you know, if that had come out on the day of the actual assault, it's like it would have made it far more difficult for the feds to demonize the Davidians. But, yeah. you know,
but the point was Duncan wasn't some recluse.
No, I mean, and,
compound. So.
No. And it says, you know, the search, if memory serves me, the search warrant, the affidavit for the search warrant said that the cop had sit there in this in the, not a roundabout, in the cul-de-sac, whatever it is, and watched him arrive, and he and his pregnant girlfriend got out, and they're going in the house. It was like, oh yeah, well that proves that we got to kill him tomorrow morning. So
yeah,
I mean, it's just it's amazing that this has not registered on the local political radar or on the Washington media radar. I mean, the Washington Post has been so worse than docile on this issue. So,
yeah, I mean, I remember this story was big for me. It's hard to tell, you know, outside of echo chambers. I don't know, you know, how it really affected the larger one, but it definitely was a huge story for me and a lot of people, I guess, in the milieu of like the, whether it be libertarian or center right or gun rights advocates, or I mean, hell, even a lot of like the there was even some like overlap with some of like the BLM people, because you were able to make crossovers between like Breonna Taylor, stuff like that. But there were definitely lots of people concerned about this at the time. But it does feel like this story never really completely got its due like it should have.
That is the understatement of the century. I mean, it should have been the biggest police, outrage of 2020. Because it was a whole lot worse than the other cases that were showcased. But saying that, it's certainly possible that the police did something a hell of a lot worse elsewhere in Baltimore City or someplace else in the U.S. But just as far as cases that got quite a bit of attention, this was a far more damning case. But, you know, it didn't stick. And I mean, it was like, it was fascinating to try to be pumping this story to editors. And it's just like, Irish need not apply.
Yeah.
So,
well, I guess with that, I guess we're kind of skirting around it. I'm not going to assume everyone's watched my whole playlist or read these stories. I think if you wouldn't mind, if you could just kind of give us a recap of the situation. So, I mean, those who aren't inundated to it like we are can understand just how fucked up this situation really was, that like this is so beyond the pale of what anyone would consider to be a rational course of action or proper or justice or anything in that the realm of those type of words. So if you could just, I guess, I know there's so many little details we can go into, and maybe we'll pick away at some of that, but just kind of like a general breakdown of what happened. And even that's kind of that's a rabbit hole of its own sort, because that then goes to all the differing narratives, which, you know, namely the families seem to have one, you know, consistent narrative throughout, and the state has an assortment of narratives throughout. So, you know, do with that information what you will, audience, but that paints a damning picture in my mind. But if we could just get like a recap of kind of what happened, if you wouldn't mind.
The audience, sure. I'm happy to do that. I'm just pulling up the, I've been racing on so many damn deadlines this week. So the Duncan Lemp case started out, Duncan Lemp was outspoken about his support of gun rights. He was libertarian leaning. He had posted a photo of a rifle on Instagram, tagged it to his hometown, Potomac, Maryland, and added a caption, "Green tip armor piercing gets the girls wet." As far as I know, he didn't have any illegal ammo with him, but Maryland police cited that posting on Instagram to help get a no-knock warrant that allowed them to go in at 4:41 a.m. George Orwell, in his novel 1984, said, if you want a picture of the future, imagine a boot stomping on a human face forever. That was what actually is probably the best symbol of the Duncan Lemp case. So the cops come in there. Cops make no effort to talk to him. Cops claim they had to do this raid because he had an illegal assault weapon. It turned out in the official report 8-9 months later that they admitted, well, it was a legal rifle, but we saw the picture on Instagram and we misidentified it, but it was like a minor paperwork error after they killed the guy, in significant part because they claimed he had an illegal assault rifle. Flip side on that, Supreme Court 2 years ago basically said that the Maryland assault rifle law was probably going to be struck down. But so you got Duncan Lemp talking about firearms online, visiting some groups that were pro-gun outside for campouts or stuff like that, talking to people he met about guns. And apparently there were a couple confidential informants who were, you know, jotting down stuff which he was saying, adding it to his dossier. And when the cops decided to take him down, a significant reason was that he had made anti-police and anti-government comments to confidential informants. I guess this is why they have confidential informants. But so the raid starts out, the judge gives a Montgomery County SWAT team a no-knock warrant so they could go in anytime they wanted. And at 4:42 a.m., March 12th, 2020, SWAT team arrives outside the Lemp household, where Lemp is sleeping next to his pregnant girlfriend. The cops use a battering ram to smash in the front door of the Lemp resident. It was a no-knock warrant. But at the same time, you had other cops that did a break and rake attack on the bedroom where Lemp was sleeping next to his pregnant girlfriend. And so what you had one cop smash in the window, the glass window. Another cop stepped up and pulled back with a rake and pulled back the curtain. Then then one of the other cops stepped up with a rifle and shot Lemp three times quickly. The cop said that Lemp had been going for his rifle, but we've got to take their word for it because the cops had body cams with them, but they did not turn on the body cams until after they had killed Duncan Lemp. But getting back to that George Orwell thing, one of the most striking details that came out of the new legal papers I saw recently on this was that after Lemp was shot three times, he's laying on the floor, he's bleeding profusely, his eyes are open, he's basically terrified, he realizes he's going down. Cops don't do any first aid, but a cop steps up and puts his boot on Lemp's throat.
Yeah, which I saw that in your article, and I assumed when I re-listened to that Casey episode, she did say something, and I'm assuming maybe because there were legal stuff going on at the time, I think, when we streamed that. So I assume maybe she was being careful in her wording, but she did say something that, you know, along the lines that they didn't provide any medical help, and it seemed like they may even have worsened it or hastened it essentially. So she was vague in her wording. So I'm assuming that is something along the lines that she was alluding to in the fact that they essentially increased his discomfort as he passed.
Yeah. So something which I forgot to mention is just before they shot Lemp, they threw in two flashbang grenades into the bedroom. And I was going back and forth with the guy who was a cop apologist, if not a cop, on Twitter, I guess a week and less. And he was insisting that the flashbangs weren't any really big deal, you know. And so I was thinking, what happens if someone goes into police headquarters and sets off a flashbang? I think the person's life expectancy would be less than 15 seconds. But these were classified by one North Carolina court as a weapon of mass destruction. They basically completely disorient people. And it's a way of just tyrannizing people who you're searching. And it's basically assuming that the people the police have targeted have zero constitutional rights and basically zero right to live. Because if you do that kind of attack, there's a lot of guys I know that if you did that kind of attack on their house, at that time of day, you know, somebody would be going down. And the cops know this. I mean, this is a problem they had with no-knock raids, especially pre-dawn no-knock raids going back, you know, 30, 40 years. They don't care. It's like once they get as a no-knock warrant, it can it's practically it can be turned into a death warrant. So.
Yeah, I know for me for sure if that happened in my house, I'd be getting shot. And I even said on my episode with Casey, is like if I had some magical thing in my head that told me this is cops whenever this event happened, I wouldn't do it. And that's not because I have some deference to cops. It's mostly just because it's I don't want to do something that's pointless. It's going to get myself killed or get others hurt. But yep. Being a man, if that happens, you know, some disorienting thing happens in the middle of the night, wakes me from my immediate thought is going to be to protect my family. And yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, this is human nature. So, you know, 3 months before that, a couple months before that attack, Lemp's last tweet was, "The Constitution is dead." March 12th, so was he. Lemp had said to his mother that the police might target him, quote, "because I exercise my constitutional right." And with that videotape, with the body cam was turned off during the actual attack, but the body cam was turned up a Freedom of Information Act request by Judicial Watch. And one of the things that struck me was it shows Mercedes Lemp sitting on her bed weeping after the police had killed her son. Mercedes told me in 2021, "I will always wonder whether the police intended to kill Duncan from the start. There was never a search. It seemed that the way that they conduct themselves, it was as if they intended to kill him even before the raid began." So it looks like a targeted killing. Maybe that wasn't the intent, but if that's not the intent, then how come the government has withheld almost all the evidence here?
Yeah, and even then, it's a difference, in my opinion, given these actions, it's a difference without any sort of real substantive distinction. Like, you can say, I wasn't intending to kill him, but you did everything in your power that would put you in a situation to where you would essentially have to. Because they said, from my understanding, they broke through his window while breaking through another area in the house, threw in a flashbang, so to his head, he woke up to some sort of concussive blast, bright light, and immediately was in a fear of having to protect his family. And from the episode with Casey, she was saying, I believe it was either a day or two prior to that, they had some other guy who had been acting fishy. I don't know if you'd seen that elsewhere, if that was exclusive to that interview with her. I'm not sure. I don't remember seeing that elsewhere. But she said she had someone who looks like maybe some sort of informant that was probably maybe gearing up for something beforehand. Talking weird, you know, essentially saying stuff that she, after the fact, was kind of like, that seemed like something a Fed would do type deal. Like saying stuff like, oh, we should really get at cops and stuff. And they got a weird feeling from, and
this is such a cliche. Wow.
Yeah. She was saying that she didn't get the feeling that, she was actually attributing this to whenever that happened with Duncan, that he may have been on higher alert is what it sounded like to me because of that situation, because he was seeming weird and they were all thrown off by that. So they weren't thinking cops whenever this happened, and obviously they weren't alerted. So it's like, in a certain sense, if that was part of their operation, it's like they already then kind of primed him to be even more on edge. Like, what is going on here? So, I mean, I don't know. I don't know how substantive that angle is, because that was something she's brought up, that there was some weird guy hanging around her house a day or two prior. I don't know if you ever looked into that. I found that very interesting when she brought that up.
Yeah, I don't know that, but I was told that there were informants around, and there was a protest at Montgomery County Police Headquarters. Mm. I guess was the following month, and you know there were a number of folks there who, how do I put this gracefully? Let's just say that they were playing both sides. They seemed to be playing both sides. One especially who didn't show up after encouraging other people to show up and bring their guns, knowing that the Montgomery County police would arrest anybody with a firearm. So it's mm-hmm. like, you know, it's possible to protest the government without being an idiot.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
But there were some of the loudest people prior to that protest at the county police headquarters were just telling people to bring their guns, but just stand away a little bit. And if they ask, just tell them that you're not part of the demonstration, and then it'll be okay to have a gun. And I'm thinking, okay, you know, I'm guessing this guy didn't go to law school.
Yeah. I mean, to be fair, I guess that does kind of draw into, I believe Duncan did tap into, there was that Boogaloo Boy phenomenon at the time. I don't know if he would consider himself one of those, but he was definitely sort of tied into that milieu. So that was kind of consistent with some of those guys' type of ideology of like,
yeah, I mean, I can understand folks who have got, who are profoundly wary of government power and government officials. But here again, I mean, it's important not to be an idiot. My impression is that there were a lot of government informants in some of those groups, and they were basically leading people down the path to, personal ruin, or trying to do that. So, and it's unfortunate that you have a protest group, and next thing you know, it's sort of like, it's, it probably wasn't quite as bad as a Ku Klux Klan in the 1960s, where you had half the members were FBI agents undercover. But folks need to keep up their guard. And there was an old saying in the late 60s at the anti-war protest that the person who was advocating violence was probably an undercover government agent.
Yep. Which, you know, as Casey was bringing up by that guy, she mentioned how he made comments about, you know, wanting to do violence to law enforcement. And she was like, what? And that is common. I have a whole playlist on the Michigan Whitmer kidnapping thing. It was the same stuff. Yep. Almost all of the guys involved as far as I'm aware, none of the guys agreed to any sort of violent action. And the ones that I talked to, because I did talk to at least Brandon Caserta, I can't remember if I talked to any other guys. But he was like, they did kind of push that. And anytime that sort of information came up, those guys were always like, what? No. And it always was the feds that were pushing that sort of narrative. So
And it's just, you know, folks that go and that folks that want to be want to go public about their distrust of government, or their, throwing the, their distrust of the officials, you know, you got to have your BS radar on. I gave a talk to a Libertarian Party about, it was talking about Duncan, it was a Maryland Libertarian Party. It was talking about the Duncan Lemp case about a year afterwards. And it was about 3 months after the January 6th. And at that point, the FBI was going around, already going wacko, just dragging people in and, you know, all kinds of BS charges. I'm not sure if they were already charging people with parading without a permit, but it was going in that direction. And I've written about, you know, federal perjury prosecutions going back. I did a story for Playboy on that, I think 1998. And you see how these things are done, and the federal, the undercover agent draws you out. Well, what about this? What about that? Oh, isn't that a damn shame? And it's like, you know, there was a podcast. I don't know if it's still around, but it was something like the Pot Lawyers for Hire out of California. And it had these two middle-aged hippie looking guys who were lawyers. And, you know, there was one, Bobby, if you're there and the cops come, what do? You shut the fuck up. And that was the refrain again and again and again for the podcast. And it's actually very good legal advice because in a situation like that, you know, you can't explain, especially if they're trying to trap you or trying to get a real simple thing. These FBI 302s. People don't realize. People say, well, you know, I'm a patriot. I was a Boy Scout. I was in the military. I have nothing to hide. I'll just tell the tell the FBI agent how it was. Well, you sit down and you talk to him for an hour, and, you know, there is no tape recording. Maybe there was another agent taking notes. And then afterwards, the FBI agent goes back and writes up a memo and has you saying what he wants you to have said. And it's like, and it's up to you to go to court and say, well, the FBI lied. Yeah, good luck with that.
Yeah, so they don't ever lie. What are you talking about?
Well, it's an interesting thing that there was at least one U.S. attorney, I believe, out in Arizona, who was pushing for the FBI to start tape recording these interviews because jurors were starting to throw out FBI testimony because the FBI had been caught making so many false statements. I mean, if you you're down there in Florida, you think of the Orlando Pulse case. Holy smoke! That was a mushroom cloud. I mean, I was so sad to see that go down.
Mm. Yeah, it is wild, and it's crazy. I'm pretty sure it's illegal to lie to a federal agent as well, at least in an interview type scenario. So the fact they don't interview it, and you also can get legally prosecuted for lying, that seems to be kind of a bit of a boondoggle there. It's setting yourself up for failure.
Boondoggle is not the word for it. I mean, that Orlando Pulse trial, I think the trial was in 2018. The massacre was in 2016. Politicians framed that as proof that gays were being persecuted. I mean, the FBI knew very early that the evil guy who did the attack was was not anti-gay. He just wanted to kill a lot of Americans. They had the motive, but then so the feds decided to prosecute his widow, claiming that she knew. So that she's not too bright, didn't speak much English. They interrogated her for like 17 hours in a row without a lawyer, and they were threatening to take away her baby. She finally said, "Okay, I'll sign a confession." So the FBI writes up this lurid confession. I did this and I did this and dun, 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 dun. And the FBI is great triumph. They take it into court. The lawyers for the lady take one look at it, and it's a turkey shoot because there were a number of brazenly false statements in her confession. And the entire case collapsed like a souffle. So
yeah, it reminds me of a Marina Oswald, I believe. They interviewed, which was Oswald's from the JFK shooting, his wife, which she was from Soviet Russia. So I always found that funny that the FBI, she was like in her early 20s. Some scared young girl from Soviet Russia, and they're, oh, we should take what she says with, as meaning a lot. And you're like, like, even if you guys didn't try to mess with her at all, it's like she's still coming from Soviet Russia in her early 20s. The president is dead in another country. And she's like, she has this mentality of dealing with Soviet Russia of like, I should just say whatever the hell they want to hear from me.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. So, no, I mean, you saved your ass that way.
But I did want to get to, it sounds like there were some new legal proceedings going on with the Duncan Lemp stuff. So if you could inform my audience of what's going on with that, because I'm not really abreast with what's going on now. I know there were some things here and there Casey kind of alluded to, but it seems to be kind of, from a legal perspective, it seemed like it was dead in the water for a while. I don't know if they were, sitting on stuff waiting for a special moment to strike, but it sounds like there's some new legal proceedings going on. Correct me if I'm wrong. I got that inference from your article. So what is the current going on in that? And do you think
my understanding is that there was a wrongful death lawsuit that was filed on the day or two before the statute of limitation in Maryland. They're also pursuing a court remedy under Section 1983, a federal law provision that dates back to the post-Civil War era when they had to put in a federal law because a lot of the Southern courts, governments were simply ignoring the horrendous abuses that were suffered by the freed slaves. So this Section 1983, it was a pretty good. It was a law that had some use prior to the last 40 years. Things have gone downhill a lot since then. Police can claim qualified immunity and escape almost all charges. That is what at least I think two of the Montgomery County policemen who have been charged have claimed. Thus far, as far as I know, there's been. The lawyer pushing this has not gotten discovery yet or even done depositions. There have been a lot of motions by the government side and some court delays. So this is something, I mean, as a journalist, it's frustrating as hell because I would love to see the internal police records on this. what sort of planning did they have before the raid? Or was it like, well, this is a street address and this is the time of day? I'm sure they had more than that. I would think that they did some type of assessment. I'm also wondering if there was if the state attorney's office report on December 31st, 2020 focused heavily on the comments that Duncan Lemp had made about police and government, anti-police, anti-government. Well, you know, I live in the same county and I haven't said one or two things over the years. So I would be curious if there is a clear legal standard which they put on paper, which would show who the government's going to be targeting with police raids or targeting with confidential informants. I mean, Maryland's also a very aggressive state on red flag laws. There was 2 years before Duncan Lemp, there was a guy outside of Annapolis. Police come to his door, 5 a.m., bang on the door, they got a warrant to seize his gun. Argument occurred, police kill him. And he had not done any violence to anybody, but, well, you know, someone said he might be violent, so, you know, they had to kill him. And, of course, this being Maryland has some of the strongest police unions. I think it was the first state that had what's called a Law Enforcement Bill of Rights, which is kind of difficult to distinguish between a license to kill. So, but there are so many other records that would be show what the mindset was of the police and show whether they learned anything from this. And I think what they learned is to make sure they're going to do a killing, make sure that the Washington Post is on their side. So,
yeah. What I'm assuming this is probably criminal side as opposed, or not criminal, civil as opposed to criminal. Correct me if I'm wrong. I guess I'm just trying to get at what could they actually see from this? Because, I mean, obviously we would love to, you know, get some sort of justice. But at the end of the day, I really would like to see something go back to the family because, I mean, as we mentioned before, some kid lost his father who, you know, theoretically was going to be, you know, at least 50% of, you know, what provided for him the rest of his life. And now he's luckily, it seems like Casey's in a good position with the with Duncan's family. So she's supported there is what it seems like, unless something's changed since I've talked to her. But either way, they took a huge economic, like even just looking at from a just economically speaking, they took a huge chunk out of their life just from that alone. By tanking Duncan, that, you know, theoretically, you know, they would be at a position where they probably had their own place, maybe another kid, who knows what the situation be now. So, I mean, it's kind of the unseen. So I guess I'm just trying to get at what can we actually hope to see out of, I mean, I guess at the very least, I'd like to see if we could get some discovery out of this and get some more information, more damning stuff, because it sounds like there's probably some damning information to be had here. Maybe they're hoping it's been long enough, no one will give a shit, but I still do, and I know you still do, so hopefully.
Yeah, I mean, if I had to guess, I would say that the stuff that's been withheld is vastly more damning than what we've learned. It's sad that the single best source of information on this is that state's action, the state attorney's report, and that has multiple layers of BS, which, you know, I had fun writing about. As an investigative journalist, it's like, I'm glad I found some things. I think there's a heck of a lot more out there. And, you know, I hope that the lawsuit makes progress, but there's so much culpability for that the police, the county government, and Maryland was able to sweep this under the rug and not have to answer any questions. Because, I mean, you know, it's almost impossible to get these people on their record. So, you know, some days I almost get cynical.
Yeah, I mean, hopefully we get some more out of this. I mean, this is if you extrapolate this story, it's incredibly dark because, I mean, this is let's be real, he's a white guy from an affluent neighborhood. I mean, he's just kind of like, I don't even think he was really, from my looking into his beliefs, he was really all that extreme. He's not even as extreme as I would consider myself to be. Not that I'm saying I advocate for violence, but I would consider myself an anarcho-capitalist. I don't even think Duncan Lemp was that far. I don't even think he was an anarchist. I think he was kind of like a guy who liked government, like a minarchist type person, for those who understand those labels. That's what I got out of Duncan, minarchist, who kind of just liked gun rights and generic constitution type stuff. And that's kind of where he was coming from. But my point being is, if you extrapolate from this, it's just kind of just being a normal guy who generally just kind of likes freedom, liberty, whatever. You are up for grabs for being murdered. Like, that's really what this story says. I mean, he didn't really commit any crimes as far as we're aware. I mean, I guess he had something from when he was a minor, but he wasn't even aware he supposedly wasn't supposed to buy guns. But even that's kind of like up in the air. So
yeah, and I mean, the thing about that is that he wasn't informed of that, and and his gun purchases were approved by both Maryland and the feds. So I mean, but here again, I mean, a baseline absurdity here. It was easier for the cops to kill him than to talk to him.
Yep.
And when you've got that kind of slanted playing field, you're going to end up with a lot of dead, innocent people.
Yep. Well, James, it's been a pleasure talking to you. I've been looking forward to this for a long time, for years, actually, finally having a conversation with you, and we just finally got around to it.
So is it possible to do a two-second plug here for the new book?
Oh, yeah. I was actually literally about to segue into what you're working on now.
Go for it. About. Go for it.
Yeah. So, all right. So what are you working on these days, Jim?
I've got a new book that just came out. It's called Last Rights, The Death of American Liberty. And it's a, let's see if this works. No, that doesn't work. And so it's a fun, this is, it's got a better, let's see. Okay. So it looks better on Amazon. But it has the Duncan Lemp case. It also talks about that in the context of no-knock raids, because 30 years ago I wrote for Playboy on no-knock raids. I've written a lot for it since then. There were parallels with the Duncan Lemp case with Ruby Ridge that I wrote a lot about, and the FBI chief publicly condemned me for my articles on Ruby Ridge. That was a hoot. And there's a chapter in this Last Rights, the new book, called The War on Gun Owners, which walks through, which uses the Lemp case as well as on the assault weapons case, because there was a line in the official report by Montgomery County that says, well, you know, okay, so it wasn't an illegal gun, but it's a very narrow, complex thing, and it's kind of a gray area, what's legal and what's not. Well, then why do you have the damn law? It's like, okay, if it's a gray area, well, this week that's legal, next week it's not. I mean, it's sort of like the bump stock thing, you know. It's like, make up your minds. So, but it was fun to do that book because I tied in a lot of the stuff I've done on censorship, surveillance, and FBI rascality. I mean, I've got a fun section there on the Orlando Pulse. I did a piece for USA Today when that trial went down, and it was like, yeah, I just, you know, I felt so bad for those FBI agents.
Yeah, it really is. I did want to kind of make a note on the no-knock raids thing. It is one of those things that the more you think about it, the more it's just such an absurdity, like the fact that this is even a thing, because I feel like most people think of no-knock raids and they think of the worst case scenario possible. But I would say even in your worst case scenario, it's probably a really stupid fucking idea to do a no-knock raid. Like, because I think people have this idea in their head of, I don't know, some crazy cartel hold up somewhere, and we're just going to come in guns
ablazing. Hostages. You got to rescue the hostages, just like Waco.
It's like, yeah, exactly. And so, but it's like, if you do that, though, you're going to put your people in harm's way, whatever, hostages. You're immediately going to put the subject in a situation of fight or flight. So it's like, it makes no, like, maybe you could make some crazy, you know, outlier case for why this specific situation, maybe it could work. But even then, I would say most times, no. But it's like, for 99.99%, it's like, no, this is clearly an awful idea.
Well, yeah, and certainly for the vast majority of raids as they're being done now. And it's just, it's funny, I was at the, I was writing about this in the mid-90s, and the Supreme Court heard a case, Wilson versus Arkansas. This was a lady who had sold some drugs to a government informant, small amount, marijuana, I think it was. And then the cops came by and did a no-knock raid afterwards and, you know, didn't shoot her, but But her lawyer challenged the evidence and claimed a violation of the Fourth Amendment, protecting people from unreasonable searches. And so the lawyers are arguing there in front of the court, and the Chief Justice Rehnquist makes some quip, and everybody in the court goes, ha, ha, ha. And then the defense lawyer for this lady from Arkansas was, the feds were saying that, okay, that maybe someone would deserve a knock and announce if the amount of drugs was so large it couldn't be flushed away. And what the defense lawyer said was, so what you're saying is that the more drugs people have, the more constitutional rights that they get. Well, I thought that was hilarious, but I was the only person in the courtroom who laughed out loud. And I'm sitting in the press box, and 2 minutes later, I get a tap on the shoulder from the bailiff. I get thrown out of the court because I laughed at the defense lawyer. So, but 15 years later, New York Times, other places are saying, yeah, that has become the law of the land. That if you've got a shitload of drugs, well, you know, okay, we've got a warrant here. We've got to take a look. Oh, dude might flush. Boom, let's nail him. Flush toilets cancel the Fourth Amendment. I mean, there's so many levels of absurdity here. And it's good just to try to, you know, make people recognize that, you know, there's so much worse bullshit than you suspect.
Yeah, who knew the advent of indoor plumbing would mean the necessitation of taking our rights?
So. Yeah, it's so many levels, so...
Well, with that, James, Jim, you want to let us know, let our audience know where they can find you at, kind of where you're putting your work out these days. Obviously, I know you just talked about your book. Highly recommend it. I know I followed a lot of your work article wise, so I haven't checked out that book yet. So I'm just recommending it based on previous work. So.
Hey, I'm happy to send you a copy. I'm doing a lot for the New York Post. They've been fun to work with. They welcome my sense of humor. I was did my first YouTube show with them last week, a YouTube video making fun on Biden and shrinkflation, doing stuff for libertarianists with Scott Horton's folks, doing stuff for Mises Institute, doing stuff for Bumper Hornberger and Future Freedom Foundation, some other places. So, thanks for asking.
Oh, yeah, no problem. I keep up the great work. You have been, I mean, like I said, with all the work, not that I've done some great amount of work on the Duncan Lemp stuff, but the little bit I've had, you were one of the primary sources of information that I looked to for digging into that. So, that's the effect you've had, and I'm sure you've had it on others. But I really appreciate your work and hope to see more from you in the future and hope to see more people checking out your work as well. But with that, this is the No Way Jose Show. You can find this on YouTube, all the major podcatchers, Rumble as well. Make sure to give it a like, share, subscribe, comment, all that good stuff. If you want to support me, patreon.com/NoWayJose2020. And with that, we are out.